Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks. Happy Tuesday, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh Edition.
And as you know, this is the place where we talk about those aspects of Scripture, those books in the most recent few years that may not get as much attention because sometimes they're part of the Haftarah reading. They're certainly not part of the regular Torah cycle, or of late they're not part of the apostolic writings, the so-called New Testament either. But in any case, what we're trying to do is to go through them and especially look at some of the prophetic understandings. And most recently, of course, we started into the book of Ezekiel. And the last couple of weeks is actually one of my, I would say, favorite, but certainly most dramatic places in the prophecies of Ezekiel, because they have to do with things that literally demonstrate the hatred that Yah has for the kinds of paganism that have crept into the, let me call it what it is, the whore church. And, of course, we saw the story with the angel with the inkhorn, who is going to literally slay all of those who do not have the mark of Yah because they do not sigh and cry at all the abominations. Abominations that sounded real similar to what we've heard in the Romanized, paganized church, Lent, and sunrise services, and a whole lot of stuff that represents even greater abominations for a long time. And, of course, the answer, he says, go slay them and begin at my sanctuary, all of which ought to, at the very minimum, raise eyebrows and give people concern about, wow, how much paganism has crept in. What are we putting up with? And, of course, we can look in the Torah, and I reference this frequently, Deuteronomy chapter 7 and 12 and 13, where he makes it real clear. But don't even bring an abomination into your house. And we'll have a little bit more of that this week. We're also going to see some stuff that we just started into last week, chapter 10, that's a little bit, I won't say confusing, but the descriptions are certainly not like anything we've seen before. And that's what most of chapter 10 is about. So anyway, with that introduction, we began to look at chapter 10 last week. Let me go say good afternoon to Mark Patron. He is on. And unfortunately, as of yet, we don't have Ken Irvin. Hopefully he'll be here before too long. Maybe he got stuck in traffic in the swamp area there. But in any case, we're looking for him. We'll keep our eyes open or our ears open. MP, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. We're doing pretty well over here. My my father-in-law is going to be 95 this coming weekend.
And older than the queen.
What was that?
Older than the queen.
Older than no, not quite as old as she was. 96 when she croaked.
Oh, I thought she was 93. I guess I just misremembered.
Yeah, you just misremembered. It was only a year. I mean, when you get to our age, 1 year is not a big deal, you know.
That's true.
Imagine if you're 95. My goodness gracious. Anyway, yeah, he's a tough old guy, and he keeps me on my toes. My wife and I are here at and he's with us at our house, and so we take care of him. I had an appointment to go to see a doctor with him today, and then the doctor got canceled. Okay, so here I am. It's a good thing, but in the meanwhile, I talked about that late last week, and I told him that I was not going to be here, and then I was going to call you, Mark, to see about getting the rerun up. And we got the, so anyway, we're here in Jackson. And now, where is the book? I can see that I was in chapter 10.
You're going to have to get a bit closer to the microphone or something. You're breaking up a bit.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll just move the mic in a bit. Yeah, I think that I finished with chapter 10 and verse 4, but I'm not certain. So let me go ahead and start with verses 5 through 7. Can you read those for us?
Okay. So, yeah, so this is chapter 10, and the discussion here has to do with the cherubim. Now, let me make a quick comment here up front. When I was looking up some stuff earlier on this, I saw that one of the King James versions that was online, at least, keeps putting the word cherubims in there. And I'll admit that's kind of irritating, because a cherub is singular.
Yeah,
cherubim
so
is already plural, so cherubims is redundant. And, you know, it's important when we understand that words are not being transliterated, but just basically because we don't know what these things are anyway, they're just using the Hebrew word. We ought to at least understand what the word is. So a cherub is one of them, and cherubim is several of them, and cherubims is just plain wrong. So we're talking about the various cherubim in 5 through 7, and it says, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard even in the outer court, like the voice of Yah Almighty when he speaks. Then it happened, when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, take fire from among the wheels, from among the cherubim, that he went in and stood beside the wheels. Now, there's a lot of description of these wheels in here, and wheels within wheels. The wheels are kind of fascinating. We'll come to that in a second, and I'll probably add a little something. But I remember, a lot of folks remember the wheels from Ezekiel, Ezekiel's wheels within wheels. And they're, if nothing else, enigmatic because they're so bizarre. We haven't ever seen anything quite like them. So it says, the cherub, singular, stretched out his hand from among the cherubim to the fire that was among the cherubim, and he took some of it, and he put it into the hands of the man clothed with linen, who took it and went out. And then he goes into this description. The cherubim appeared to have the form of a man's hand under their wings. Now, it says the form of several places in here. So what he's saying is, it looks like he had a hand under there, but can you really be sure that's what it was? But it's what it looked like. As for their appearance, all four looked alike, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Let's pause there, and I'll go to MP and let him kind of catch up.
All right. Well, I'm going to cover verses 5 through 7 here real quickly. Now, why is it that the sound of the cherubims, that's an apostrophe S telling you that it's possessive, okay? That the cherubim's wings is so reminiscent of Yah's voice. It's likely because the cherubim do nothing without the order from the Almighty. They are his messengers to either act or fulfill and on God's requirements on earth. Annoying noise, whatever that is.
Yeah. Maybe Ken joined us, but nope, it doesn't look like it.
Doesn't look like it, okay. So, anyway, let's see. That they are his messengers to act or reveal to men what they need to do to act on Yah's requirements on earth. Now, when the... Excuse me just a second. I need to get rid of this. Okay. There it is again. To reveal what men that they need to do to act on Yah's requirements. In Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 24, it says, and when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, like the voice of the Almighty, the speech, like the noise of a host. When they stood, they let down their wings. In effect, the wings of the cherubim are performing the word of Yah. Yah speaks, it performs. On verse 5. And the sound of the cherubs were heard as far as outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks, in verse 5. The outer court is the rest of the Temple Mount outside of the inner courtyard. No, for the verse says that it was like the voice of El Shaddai when he speaks. In other words, the great voice in which he spoke at Mount Sinai, in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 19. Azamra's verse 5 and 19 is KJV's 5:22, and Moshe speaking. They say, these words Yah spoke unto all your assembly in the mount out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick darkness with a great voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them in two tables of stone and delivered them unto me. Back to Azamra on verse 5. They say this. But when it reached the outer courtyard, it stopped and went no further. The screen of Tsimtsum, that is limitation or contraction, intervenes, preventing all who are unworthy from hearing the inner voice of God's providence. Now, here's back to me. It should be the same with us as it is with them. The problem there is our free will and the cherubs' lack of the same, which actually explains their power compared to our lack thereof. If we were almighty, this world would go to hell in a handbasket within minutes. What do you think is happening with the world's governments as we speak? The world has renounced Yah and thinks it is all that and a bag of Cool Ranch Doritos. Now, the purely physical, they kind of are. But there is a Yah in heaven, and he is going to let out just a little more rope, which is attached to the collar that he has on the world system, before he gives it a hard yank. It'll be like the cartoon dog who reaches the end of the rope. Do you think Yah gives gets a kick out of that kind of stuff like we do? Those cartoons are funny because no one actually gets hurt. It will not be the same for those who think they are all that. Yah, have mercy on them, because but for your grace, rather, it would be me. Okay, now in verse 6, El Shaddai commanded the faithful priest, clothed in linen, to enter the sanctuary and to take fire from between the wheels, the Ophanim, from between the Keruvim. This priest did not take the coals from the fire, but waited for the Keruv to remove it from the fire and place it in his hand, in verse 7. Then he left the sanctuary with the burning ember. Yeah, that's what I got through verse 7. And
Okay, well, I've read ahead. So, okay. I mean, do you have anything else to add on the next few verses? Basically, they're descriptions. And there's a wheel,
yes,
for each cherub. And we're going to go talk a little bit more about the wheel. So if you want to add anything, I'll pause. Otherwise, we'll just continue.
Yeah, I'll cover the rest of the chapter here. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So where did we finish reading?
I read through about
verse
9.
Did you read all the way through the chapter?
I read through 8, actually, about their hands.
Okay, and then we talk about that case, why don't you read the rest of the chapter?
All right, so we've got, basically, the cherubim have this, what looks like a hand under their wings. And when I looked, he says, there were 4 wheels by the cherubim. One wheel by one cherub and another wheel by each other cherub. The wheels appeared to have the color of a beryl stone. As for their appearance, all 4 of them looked alike, as it was a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now, let me pause here and make a note. It's even going to say in a couple verses, hey, they even get called, within my hearing, wheels. So the question, of course, comes up, well, no, that's not what they were called. They didn't say, hey, oh, wheel. They actually called them something. And in the Hebrew, the word there is ha-gagal, galgal. And it's not only wheel, that's the most common usage, but it turns out if you look it up, this is kind of interesting, I thought at least. The first place that it appears in the English Bibles is in the Psalms. So it does not show up in the Torah, this word, at all. And it shows up in the book of Ecclesiastes and in a number of the prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel all mention this same word, galgal. So obviously this is one of those things that people saw, and it seems to post-date a lot of the references in the Torah. Now, what I thought was interesting, again, is that word there is has multiple meanings, at least as a possibility. Wheel is just one of them. Another one is whirlwind or whirl. And when I see a wheel within a wheel, I think whirl may even be a better way of putting it, or a whirlwind. If you look at Psalm 77, where it first appears, he's talking, the psalmist is talking about a storm, it sounds like. The voice of thy thunder was in Hashemayim. Oops, no, it's not Hashemayim. It's Ha-Gal-Gal. Ha-Gal-Gal. It's kind of hard to say. So it's a different word than we normally use for heavens. But that's the way it's rendered in the Psalms, the first time the word appears. So, again, I'm going to suggest, like chaff in a whirlwind, there's a number of references you'll see in the various concordances here. But maybe another way to put it is something that whirls around. And certainly a whirlwind does that. Various kinds of things you look when you flush the toilet. They didn't have toilets, but they would have certainly seen circulating water doing that in various places. And maybe that's where the reference to the wheels comes from, because they saw it in nature first. That's what I want to add there. We'll come back to that, MP. But go ahead. What do you want to put in there?
Okay. Well, in verse 8, Zamora gives us this. They say in verses 8 and following, the prophet gives further description to the cherubs, the chayos that he saw in the vision of chapter 1, and the ofanim, describing again how the ofanim, the omnidirectional wheels of the chariot, automatically went wherever the head, the cherub, the beast drawing it, went. Okay, so the whole idea is that the guy that's driving this vehicle, whatever it is, it's got all these wheels on it, is the one that decides which way it goes. Okay, so there were four cherubim, one on each, for lack of an easier to understand word, corner or side of the chariot. Okay, one cherub on each side of the chariot. The KJV describes in verse 9 that the four wheels direct the chariot, as it were. First one, then another direction, the chariot, the chariot in its direction. Sounds as though it moves as far as it needs to towards the north or south, and then towards the east or west until it got to its destination. That's the way it seems to be working to me. Now, the wheels were the color of beryl, which is a greenish-colored crystalline gemstone. So we've seen a deep blue sapphire and a light green beryl, sort of the colors of the sky and of the water. The wheels look like a tire on an automobile or aircraft wheel, one inside the other, each turning in the same direction, like an automobile or aircraft wheel would do while it's on the ground. You suppose? Nah, it couldn't be, could it? That it's an aircraft? Like just a flying, you know, like could be anyway. And verse 10 tells us that it looks like a wheel in a wheel. So that's kind of interesting to me. Was Zeke getting glimpses of ends of days happenings? It could be. When it moved in one direction and then another, as above. Now, I think in verse 14, Zeke is describing its motions as I did above. The south-facing wheel moved the direction as far as necessary, and then the east-facing wheel until the wheel reached its destination. It doesn't tell us which creature is facing which direction, but unless this vehicle reached an obstruction that it couldn't overcome, the vehicle could just do a quick detour around the obstacle and be on its way. Now, Azamra has this on the rest of the chapter, and I'll be quickly finished after I get done with Azamra here. And every one of the cherubs, or the chayos, had four faces. The first face was the face of a cherub. The second face was the face of a man. The third, the face of a lion. And the fourth, the face of an eagle. That's all verse 14. Now, Yehezkel himself tells us in verse 20 that the cherubs that he saw in the present vision were themselves the chayos that he saw in his vision at the river Kavar in Ezekiel 1:5 and following. The only difference is that in the present vision, he saw the face of a cherub instead of the face of an ox that he had seen at the river Kavar. Is it the same? Is the cherub's face the face of an ox? I don't know. We hear other places where it's the face of a young child. Okay, anyway, our sages opened a tiny chink into the mystery of the reason for this change when they said that Ezekiel begged Elohim to have mercy, asking how the accuser, the golden calf or an ox, could become a defender, one of the drawers of the divine chariot, according to the Talmud Haggigah in 13a. Remember, this is all coming from Azamra, which is an Orthodox Jewish website. Now, with Ezekiel watching, this is still quoting Azamra, with Ezekiel watching, the divine chariot makes successive journeys out from the temple. As long as the temple stood, it was at the very center of everything. All the lines of God's providence radiated outwards from there to the entire world. Even today, God's providence remains at the center of everything, but from the time of the destruction of the temple, ascended from there and can no longer be seen to be manifestly radiating from Jerusalem. It continues to govern the world, but it does so from a place of mystery. Blessed be the glory of Hashem from his place, is what it says in Ezekiel chapter 3 and verse 12. Okay, and that's a kedushah, a good saying. Then, in verse 16, see that the vehicle can fly. I'm thinking helicopters, which can fly in any direction, depending on the tilt of the main rotor. I have flown in a helicopter many times. I worked on helicopters for 6 years in the Navy. Flown on helicopters many times, and once we actually flew backwards, not very far, but back. In fact, our helo lifted off the frigate. I was on a fast frigate with helo deck, and the frigate flight deck backwards most of the time. Okay, the helo lifted off the frigate's flight deck and moved backwards because right directly in front of them, about 30 feet in front of the rotor arc, was the hangar for the helicopter. And if they moved forward, they were probably going to crash into it. So they always lifted off and moved backward. A helicopter can do that. And I really think it's possible that these guys could have been helicopters if they were looking at something in our time. Okay? Which is a possibility. I don't think it is necessarily, but the description of the operation is reminiscent. Now, in other words, Zeke may have been given a glimpse of the future end of days, which I think are getting closer every second. Hallelujah. That's what I got for the rest of the chapter.
Okay, well, I can't disagree with the fact that they're getting closer every second, because that's kind of the nature of time flow. One way or the other, we're getting closer. We might be pretty close, as a matter of fact.
And, very close, I think.
So let me just kind of summarize where we're at, MP. I think we haven't read the rest of it. I'll go ahead and read the rest of it here in a second. But essentially what we're seeing here is the chapter is by and large just a long description of these things and the wheels within wheels. When you mentioned a helicopter, I mean, honestly, as long as I've been reading this since I was a little kid and I first saw Ezekiel's wheels within wheels, and I was picturing, of course, flying saucers with counter-rotating things under them. So who knows exactly, because he didn't give enough of a technical description to know whether they're counter-rotating whirlwinds or what the case is. If you've ever seen the kind of helicopters that you can buy at a hobby store prior to the quadcopters that are out there now, which would have been four wheels, not within wheels, the kind of the standard radio-controlled helicopters that the kids grew up with had counter-rotating props. And the reason why they did that is because one rotated one way, the other rotated the other way on the same shaft, and that way you could avoid a tail rotor. The tail rotor is to prevent the helicopter from just spinning around when it tries to take off. And sounds like these guys, if they are in fact flying machines, have something similar going for them. Any other comments, Mark?
No, sir. Not on chapter 10.
Well, let's go ahead and read the rest of the description. Again, that's by and large what the chapter is a long description. So whenever they went, they went towards the four directions. They didn't turn aside when they went, but they followed in the direction the head was facing. And then it says it again. They did not turn aside when they went. And their whole body, with their back, their hands, their wings, and the wheels that the four had, were full of eyes all around. As for the wheels, they were called in my hearing, let me say it in the Hebrew, ha-gal-gal. Each one had four faces. The first face, the face of a cherub. The second, the face of a man. The third, the face of a lion. The fourth, the face of an eagle. And then it says the cherubim, all of them, the plural version here, were lifted up. This was the living creature I saw by the river Chebar. When the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. And when the cherubim lifted their wings to mount up from the earth, the same wheels also did not turn right beside them.
I pray, right, don't take me soon, cause I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
All right, we are back, folks. Second segment of the day, the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition, and the book of Ezekiel, and the prophecies in chapter 10. We went to break, and I was going to read the rest of the chapter. Essentially, this has to do with a description, kind of a detailed description, but unfortunately, as detailed as it is, it's probably still not enough for us to really form a mental picture of what these cherubim are really, flying along with, riding along with, associated with. Not clear. But they are called a Galgal, which does at least translate in some renderings into wheel. Whirlwind, I kind of like. And if you think about the helicopter analogy or some kind of a flying thing analogy, quadcopters, quadcopter has four of these, but the heads all face the same direction. They don't face in four different directions. But you can see that as we've added new elements to technology, there are a lot more possibilities, at least, about what Ezekiel is seeing here. So when we went to break, it says wherever the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. Or was it the other way around? Maybe the wheels took them. It's not clear. When the cherubim lifted their wings to mount up from the earth, the same wheels also did not turn from beside them. So remember, the cherubim have wings, and the wings are able to lift them. And, that doesn't make them sound like a helicopter, or does it? Well, remember the Osprey, the V-22 Osprey, which we see them fly over here on occasion. Is a tilt rotor aircraft where, in that case, the wheels, the whirlwinds do turn, but there are still actually wings. It's not hard for me to imagine that the wheels could provide some lift and that the wings provide enough lift and direction to do all the rest of the work. Anyway, MP, any other comments?
Yeah, you were just describing something or other 22 Osprey,
V-22.
Military aircraft that takes off like a helicopter, and then the wings and rotors become propellers. They turn so that it'll pull them like an airplane through the. It's really kind of interesting how they did that. I don't know how it worked out, but they certainly did. They were able to lift off like a helicopter and then tilt the wings and everything and the rotors, and they become an airplane that'll do fly a lot faster than a helicopter. A helicopter isn't going to get but a couple hundred miles an hour.
Not quite even that. Yeah, the problem is that when a helicopter flies fast, the wing, basically there's a retreating blade and an advancing blade is the problem. And when the helicopter is flying, there are some physical limits to things that happen with the blades when one is trying to go forward against an airstream and the other is trying to go backwards, and it just makes it difficult. So the idea of the tilt rotor is to beat that speed limit that's imposed on a normal helicopter by tilting them to where you're right. They're no longer generating the lift. The lift is being generated by the wings, and at this point, the propeller is just pulling the plane forward, and they're all working in the same direction.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling to me. Okay, but I'm not a flyer. You know, I'm the guy that maintained the thing. I'm not the guy that actually flew it. Anyway, these are very interesting descriptions here, and it really does sound like either a helicopter or possibly a tilt wing aircraft like the Osprey. Yeah.
Okay.
We're looking at stuff that's yet in our future too. Okay. I mean, yeah, it's outside of time and space. All of this stuff is going on outside of our normal way of thinking, okay? Or it wouldn't be so mind-boggling to us.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add, MP, before we continue the rest of the reading here?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so it says, when the cherubim, they stood still, the wheels stood still, and when one was lifted, well, now wait a second. If the word is wheel, then the wheel sounds like it quit rotating. But on the other hand, if the word is whirlwind, then the whirlwind could stand still and still actually be in motion, if people understand what that's saying. So when the cherubim stood still, yeah. And that cherubim is added there, it's just when they stood still. Indeed, when one was lifted up, another lifted it up, for the spirit of the living creature was in them. Then the glory of Yahuwah departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. Mark, anything?
I'm sorry, you broke up.
Oh, I just was asking, did you want to add anything before while we're there?
No, not at all.
Okay, so we have the last couple
these
of verses.
These things are pretty much mind-boggling to me. Okay, I mean, I can kind of make a connection. You know, having been involved with military aircraft and stuff, I can kind of make a connection. But it's not that clear cut of an issue as a flying machine. These are probably actual animals or creatures that Yah has created that just boggle our minds.
Well, and again, the key is we're honestly not quite sure. We just don't know.
Right.
But it says they're living creatures, but on the other hand, you know, so is a pilot flying an airplane a living creature. The living creatures may be associated with it. That's there is some enigma here. This is the living creature, he says, I saw under the Elohim of Israel by the river Chebar, and I knew they were cherubim. Each one had four faces. So here's a bit of repetition. Each one had four faces. Each one had four wings. And the likeness of the hands of a man was under their wings. And the likeness of their faces was the same as the faces which I had seen by the river Chebar, their appearance and their persons. They each went straight forward. So that ends the chapter 10. And if you're ready, we'll continue on into 11.
That's pretty freaky. They had four faces apiece, and every one four wings, with the likeness of the hands of a man under their wings. That's kind of interesting. So it's got to be controls for something. I'm thinking in my own mindset here, and it really the more I hear it, the more I'm thinking helicopter, and I'm thinking that we're seeing. In Ezekiel here, we're seeing a view into our time, or possibly a little bit beyond it. It's mind-boggling, and I can see how it would really be mind-boggling to somebody who has no clue about something that can fly, that is mechanical. Well, it's not just a bird.
Okay.
So that's what I'm thinking there, anyway.
Well, let's continue then. Then it says in chapter 10, chapter 11, first verse, then it says, the Ruach, the Spirit, lifted me up, brought me to the east gate of the house of Beit Yahuwah, literally the house of Yahuwah, which faces to the east. And there were at the door of the gate 25 men, among whom I saw, now we're going to hear some names, Yaazaniah, the son of Azur, and Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah. Princes of the people. So these are high-ranking local politicos, if you will. And he said to me, yeah. Son of man, these are the men who devise iniquity, Torahlessness, and give wicked counsel in this city, who say, time is not near to build houses, the city the cauldron, and we the meat. That's an interesting. That metaphor is going to show up in here several places. I find that really interesting. The city's a cauldron. Y'all are the meat. That sounds like something that the mayor of Chicago would say to the people. Y'all are meat, and you've had it. I don't know if that's exactly how it's intended or not, but it sure is disgusting. MP, let's pause there and let you comment on that.
All right. Where did you read through?
Just through the meat part.
I wasn't following.
Verse 3.
Oh, okay. The verse 3. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm seeing it says flesh in the KJV. Okay. All right. So here we go. Chapter 11 begins with the word moreover in the KJV, which implies that it's a continuation of the same prophecy that Ezekiel was announcing in chapter 10, which was a continuation of chapter 9, which looked like a continuation of chapter 8, where the prophecy began. 42 verses so far, with 25 more looking at us right here. Now, Azamra has this on verse 1. They say, then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the east gate of the house of Hashem. And behold, at the door of the gate, 25 men, in verse 1. These are the same men that he described earlier in chapter 8 and verse 16, having their backs to the sanctuary, except that there he did not specify who they were. But here he names two of them, according to Rashi. Now, verse 1, Ruach lifted Zeke and carried him to the east gate of the Kodesh Kadeshim. Now, remember, now Ezekiel is in Babylon, okay? And now the Spirit has taken him back to the east gate of the Kodesh Kadeshim in a vision of some kind, which does look toward the east, by the way. The east gate of the Kodesh Kadeshim looks to the east, right over to the Mount of Olives and beyond. Now, what is described here is truly ghastly to imagine, because it says that all 25 of the priests of Yah, 12 courses of two Kohanim each, in addition to the Kohen Gadol, who is intended to represent Avinu. Now, Ya'azanyah, okay, means he hears and listens to Yah, if my pidgin Hebrew doesn't fail me. After seeing this guy's character, I have to wonder if he may have assumed the name to fool people into thinking that he actually gave a damn what Yah said. Because it's obvious to me that he didn't. But he had a reputation, not his own, but the office's, to fame. He's a priest of Yah, and I believe that he is the high priest. If the 25 priests of Yah were any indication of the spirituality of the nation as a whole, well, the name Pelatiah translates to as to break out or escape Yah. These two guys, the high priest and probably his direct junior, these two guys were among the 25 who were bowing to the sun as it rose in the east and sticking their anal sphincters in Yah's face. Lovely guys, and since they are named, they were probably ringleaders in the conspiracy against Yah in the Kodesh Kadeshim. The 25 obviously had a very low opinion of Yah, almost as if they disbelieved his existence. I think they eventually discovered how wrong they were. Too late, but they found out how wrong they were. We'll see in the not-too-distant future. That's what I got in verse 1. I can move on if you'd like, unless
sure,
you'd like
ahead
to comment on that, too.
Yeah, catch up.
Okay. Azamra on 2 and 3. It's kind of lengthy. Then he said to me, this is from Jeremiah chapter 28, I believe. Then he said to me, these are the men that devise mischief and give wicked counsel in this city, who say it is not near, let us build houses. That's verses 2 and 3. This is Azamra speaking now. In his prophetic vision of Yerushalayim shortly before the destruction of the temple, Ezekiel saw the people whose stubbornness was to bring down calamity upon themselves. As we find in detail in the prophecies of Jeremiah in chapters 28 and following, despite the fact that Nebuchadnezzar had already carried off King Jehoiakim and the leading sages of the Tzaddikim of Yerushalayim to exile in Babylon, most of those who remained in the city under King Zedekiah were certain that it is not near. Okay, the prophecy that they're seeing here is not near, is what they're thinking. In other words, the prophecies of the imminent destruction of Jerusalem by Jeremiah and Ezekiel would certainly not materialize soon, and or if at all, only in the far distant future. Now, fortified by the soothing assurances of numerous false prophets, both in Jerusalem and also among the exiles in Babylon. Those who still remained at Judah were convinced that Nebuchadnezzar's empire would collapse within a couple of years and that they should be, therefore build houses and dig in for a long stay in Jerusalem. That's according to Azamra on Jeremiah chapter 28. And contrary to their ideas, in Jeremiah 29:5, it's the exiles in Babylon that he instructs to build houses and plant gardens. Okay, so he's not talking about the people in Jerusalem building houses and planting gardens. He's talking about the people in Babylon because they're going to be there for 60 or 70 years. Now, in verse 2 and 3, Ruach told Zeke, Ben-Adam, these are the enemy trying to pass for friends. Don't trust their lies. Almost like a good Louis L'Amour Western, Yah lets us know which is the good guy, whom you can trust, and whom you can't. With Yah, it's usually his prophet whom you can trust. However, these prophets are not prophets of Yah. What Yah has perhaps somehow made known to them is what these prophets are telling the people are two diametrically opposed things. What I think they have received from Yah is kind of nasty, and that they are either outright lying or dramatically embellishing to appeal to the people who outnumbered them on an order of around 1,000 to 2,000 to 1. The answer is, how many Yah-fearers are there in Jerusalem by this time? Maybe one, like Yechezkel. He's the only one there, I think. Here's Azamra on verse 3. The remaining inhabitants of Jerusalem defiantly say, the city is the cauldron and we are the meat, in verse 3. Just as the meat is not taken out from the pot until it is completely cooked, so we shall not get out of the city until we die a natural death. That according to Rashi. And that's saying the people who think they're prophets in Jerusalem are saying this. Okay? So, you got anything on that? That's through verse 3.
No, okay. I mean, that's another way to look at it. I see the meat and the cauldron showing up in here, and that doesn't quite ring true with me, but okay, go ahead.
Okay, so Ezekiel has no amanuensis or scribe writing his prophecies down. He wrote them himself. Yirmiyahu had Baruch. The whole of Yechezkel to this point is in the first person singular. This tells me that he has no actual friends among the people, and probably not among the priests for sure. But that tells me that they knew that he had Yah on his side, and they had better not conspire against him. And that means they believe Yah to be the actual creator and sustainer of all of creation. The things they count on be exactly where they have always been, but that they are in absolute rebellion against him and his prophet. In other words, they are rebellious due to their stupidity. And Hasatan counts on that stupidity to maintain his control over them. Sundown Sunday evening, this coming Sunday evening, begins Rosh Hashanah, by the way. This is the time when we look at the previous year to see if there is any unacknowledged and unrenounced sin in our lives and fall before Yah Yeshua, praising him for his atonement under the hand of the Sanhedrin of his day, which is little different from the Sanhedrin of Zeke's day. Okay? They wanted to kill Zeke. The ones in Yeshua's day actually did kill Yeshua. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 3.
Okay, well, since you went there, I was going to, at some point during the day today, get there as well, because I do think it's important, and I think that the metaphor we saw in the last couple weeks, which really isn't a metaphor, but it's a picture, at least, of what was happening then, and it's, I will contend, precisely what's happening now. They haven't even changed the names of the fake gods.
Right.
Except, of course, they claim that they've been Christianized because now bunnies and eggs and sunrise services and a little bit of a weeping for the boar that killed Tammuz and so forth, all of that's okay, weeping for Tammuz. But there is this continued reference here. We're going to see it. We'll get to it in just a minute. He is going to say negative things about these people. Not for the first time. You guys have, you've been deceptive. You've devised iniquity. Therefore, verse 7, and I'll read it right now and then we'll come back to it. Thus says Yahuwah, your slain whom you've laid in the midst, they are the meat, and this city is the cauldron, but I shall bring you out of the midst of it. You have feared the sword, I'll bring a sword upon you. So there is a nasty reference here to all of these people who have failed to do the right things. They've been doing pagan things, and their end is near. And I want to read this. This is from Leviticus chapter 23, and I think, although I suspect that the vast majority of our listeners are aware of it, again, we may differ as to the calendar days and so forth. I am personally persuaded that in the lack of any other better information, we look for the sighted new moon, because the especially this time of Yom Teruah, the blowing of the shofar, is at a new moon. It's the only one of his Moedim, his appointed times, that happens on the new moon. So, colloquially, my understanding is that during the time of Yeshua, it was known as the feast that no man knows the hour or the day. Isn't that clever? So, right. I think when they were hearing this part about no man knowing the hour of the day, they were kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge one another. Hey, it sounds like he's talking about the time of the fall feasts, starting with the countdown at Yom Teruah. So in any case, the countdown at Yom Teruah begins day one. Day 10 becomes the time, Mark mentioned it, the day of covering, Yom HaKippurim, Yom Kippur. But it says this, so this is Leviticus 23 verse 27. But we get to this 10th day of this 7th month. That would be 10 days after the blowing of the shofar, whether it comes at the conjunction, the maximal calculated new moon, or when it's actually sighted. So there's probably a day difference in there. And again, we'll find out later. But for now, the point is, I'm going to suggest people pay attention to this and observe it sometime. Howbeit, on the 10th day of this 7th month is the day of atonement. There shall be a holy convocation unto you. You shall afflict your souls. Your nefesh is the singular. Nefesh tekem. The y'all afflict your plural souls. And you shall bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Now here's the key part. It says you shall do no manner of work on that same day. Not any work whatsoever. It is a day of atonement to make atonement for you before Yahuwah your El. A day of covering is another way to look at it. For whatsoever soul it is that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from his people. And so I read that and I encourage folks, you know, read it. You got Christian friends that say, oh, this is all Old Testament stuff. Well, yeah. Notice that he says throughout your generations and all your dwelling places, Yeshua, if you believe him, he said he isn't changing not one yod or tittle as long as heaven and earth still exist. I don't care what the priests who are doing exactly what these guys that are fixing to die said. Oh, it's not happening now. No, we don't pay attention to what he says. He says, any soul that does not do this, in other words, does not afflict themselves, shall be cut off. Oh, and here's verse 30. This is the one that I think really ought to raise eyebrows. And whatsoever soul it is, nefesh, living person, that does any manner of work in that same day, that soul will I destroy from among his people. And then he follows it up one more time as if there was any doubt. No, it's not done away with. No, Jesus didn't nail it to the cross. You shall do no manner of work. Oh, here we go. It is a statute forever. A huchat olam throughout your generations in all your dwellings. What, you mean even in exile? Well, do we still have generations? Do we still have dwellings? Yeah, it's a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. And then there's more here, but I think that makes the point, MP. Again, I encourage folks, Leviticus chapter 23, verses 27 through about 33 or so. Read it. Go ahead, Mark.
Man, you're absolutely right. Yeah, but like I said, this is the time when we look at the previous year. It's coming right up. It really and truly is. I've got the Hebrew calendar here.
All right. Well, we'll pick it up after the break. We got lots to talk about.
Take me soon, as I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting.
to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true.
Welcome back now to the second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. Unfortunately, still no Ken Irvin yet. Don't know what happened to him. Mark has a hypothesis. Could be true. But in any case, he is not here, so we'll continue on. We are working our way now through Chapter 11, and basically the judgment on a bunch of people who sound a lot like what you might call modern church fathers or modern politicos, or maybe there's not much difference anymore. But basically, we're going to get to what happens to them in a second. When we went to the break, though, I was pointing out that there is a lot of advice, I guess you'd say warning in here, not just to these people, but to others, and it has to do with so many of the lies we've inherited from our fathers, especially this year. I think almost everybody listening probably realizes things have really changed. The United States, most of the world, has headed down the road to tyranny like most of us never believed, at least until we saw it, was possible, and I guess it's still true. You ain't seen nothing yet. You heard, if you listen to the what passes for news, you know, the evil ones at the UN talking about it. The Biden Fuhrer is going to address it and say, yeah, we got to crack down on all these peons out there in flyover country. We need more invaders from the south. Anything that's evil you can imagine, they're pulling it. And this is about what was happening then. So the parallels are important. And I read Leviticus chapter 23 and the warning about Yom Teruah. Which leads to the 10th day, Yom Kippur, and we got 10 days to count down, basically, once the shofar is blown, whenever you think that'll happen, sometime in the day, over the weekend or first part of next week, that we'd better be paying attention. I guess that's the way I'll put it. MP, let's go to you.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. The worst of, the Yom Teruah is coming, and that's the one where we start our new year. That's kind of interesting. It'll be here very, very shortly. And it's the year of the world that's gonna be starting again. I mean, that is the day when Yah said light, and light was. Okay. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, this is the time when we look at the previous year to see if there is any unacknowledged or unrenounced sin. I'm just covering the last sentences that I had here. In our lives and fall before Yah Yeshua, praising him for his atonement under the hands of the Sanhedrin of his day, which is very little different from the Sanhedrin of Ezekiel's day. Now remember Pilate's words in Yeshua's time. He says, I bring him forth to you that ye may know that I find no fault in him. Okay? I don't see anything wrong. I don't know. There's no reason for me to have this guy here. Anyway, in verse 6, the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him. They cried out, saying, crucify, crucify. And Pilate said, take you him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. Did you get that? Pilate says, I don't want anything to do with this. There's nothing wrong. This guy has not done anything wrong, and I'm scared to death of what's going to happen. Anyway, then in verse 14 it says, and it was the preparation of the Passover, about the sixth hour, and he said unto the Jews, behold your king. Okay, that's what Pilate said. But they cried, away with, crucify him. Pilate saith unto them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. Then delivered he him, therefore, to them to be crucified, and they took Yeshua and led him away. That is, the chief priests did that. Okay, Pilate had nothing to do with Yeshua's death, and tried all he could to release him. The third person plural noun to which that last pronoun refers is the chief priests. So it was they who led him away and crucified him. Rome had nothing to do with it. Okay? The Sanhedrin of Ezekiel's day was every bit as wicked as the one in Yeshua's day. Had they had the chance, I think they would have killed Yechezkel. both groups were of one accord. That's what I'm seeing for at this particular point anyway, up to verse 3 of our chapter.
Okay, you ready to read on then? Let's do it.
Sure.
So therefore, says Yah, prophesy against them, prophesy, O son of man. And here's another reference. Remember when we had John Behrens on a month back, and John was always inclined to make this point, that the prophet actually could speak things into existence. And when he would speak it, things would happen. So he is literally being commanded here, you prophesy against these people, and we'll see how that plays out. Then the Ruach of Yahuwah fell upon me and said to me, speak! Thus says Yahuwah, thus you have said, O house of Israel, for I know the things that come into your mind. You have multiplied your slain in this city, and you have filled its streets with the slain. Kind of, again, ought to sound reminiscent of what we've seen today with the lies and the evil, and a lot of people that are still dead men walking don't even know how bad the numbers of slain will be. All we do know is that those who have taken the poison poke are finding that fertility and stillbirths and abortions, spontaneous abortions, that kind of thing, are their legion as well. Therefore, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, your slain whom you've laid in its midst, they are the meat, and this is the cauldron, presumably the city. That word is added in italics in most Bibles. But I shall bring you out of the midst of it. You have feared the sword, and I'll bring a sword upon you, says Yahuwah Eloheka, and I will bring you out of its midst and deliver you into the hands of strangers and execute judgments on you. You shall fall by the sword. I will judge you at the border of Israel. Then you shall know, here are these words again, Ki Ani Yahuwah. No, not that I am the Lord, Ki Ani Yahuwah, that I am Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. Let's pause there. Go ahead, Mark.
All right. Okay. So, verse 4, Yah still speaking, told Zeke, prophesy. Nava is the Hebrew word to prophesy or to transmit Yah's word against them. Ben Adam, son of Adam. That's the overarching command. But I think Yah is going to get into some nitty-gritty before long. And then, in verse 5, Yah comes unto or into Yehezkel. The Hebrew is Nafal, and it means to fell upon him. It means to fall or to drop down, like a Mormon missionary at an Amway convention, you know. Zeke will know that he has no control over his lips, his tongue, or any other part of his body. The Hebrew Amar, translated as speak, means to organize speech to be heard and understood. And it's pretty unambiguous. It will be told in the most elementary fashion as possible, just to be sure that no one, and I mean nobody, will misunderstand Yah's meaning. Yah says, you, house of Israel, notice not Yehuda, but the whole house of Yaakov. I know, I yada, every thought that enters into your cute little pea brains, every one of them. Now, did they actually think that they would get away with all the rebellion and snubbing that they sent Yah's way? And by the way, do we think that we'll actually get away with the rebellion and snubbing that we send Yah's way? We're not going to. Believe me, you got to watch yourself, man. Anyway, then in verse 6, he gets into the depths of the minds and actions, okay? Remember to whom he is speaking now. These are the whole troop Kohanim, the 25 who bowed to the sun and stuck their smelly, stench-ridden sphincters in Yah's face. They had probably not even wiped. And he said, you have multiplied your slain and filled your streets with the carcasses of your prey. The Hebrew behind KJV's slain is the Hebrew 2490, halal. That's with a chet and two lamets. To profane or act against. I am pretty sure that what is profaned is the image of Yah in the thing slain. And the idea here seems to refer to the offering of the Kohanim to Yah and what they're offering. They're offering human offerings. That's what I think is going on here. Remember that they are worshiping the sun as it rises in the east. They were quite probably offering human beings to the sun, perhaps from the altar of burnt offering in the temple of Yah. That's what I got through verse 6, and I think we ought to discuss that a little bit. Because okay. I really think these guys had gone that far away from Yah.
Well, let me put it this way, MP. There would have been a time when I would have disagreed simply because I would point out, and I think this is still true, and other than what we might know from historic examples, and we know that such things did happen, we just don't know if that's specifically what he's talking about here. I don't doubt that there have been human sacrifices. We know that those were happening in, Central and South America as well. So I won't argue that that's a possibility.
Absolutely.
However, having said all of that, I look and see what's going on today. And what we're seeing today is massive, worldwide, nothing short of it, in-your-face human sacrifice. They are killing kids.
Absolutely.
They are glorifying it. They are jonesing for it. They are killing massive numbers of people with the poison poke. They're literally thrilled. They're mandating it. I can't look at what's going on in the world and not suggest, wow, these people are literally, absolutely bloodthirsty, blood-sucking, satanic legions from the pit of hell that are doing exactly what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That mRNA vaccine has caused so many blood clots and stuff like that, that are just all over people's bodies. I mean, it is absolutely, absolutely diabolical what they're doing. And it all starts with, we got this COVID kind of thing going on here, which, by the way, was created by the Chinese in their labs in Wuhan,
and they did it with American
money sent by Fauci.
There's a story There's a story in the Lancet basically saying what we've been talking about, that it may very well have been created in an American lab. And I don't think that there is no shortage of evidence on that score. You know, we've not been told the truth. That's the only thing we know for sure here.
Absolutely correct. And the media is part and parcel of the whole thing. They're laying this stuff out, and the mainstream media especially, when you talk about that, you're talking about MSNBC and places like that. Okay? Those people are lying to you all the time. All the time. If their lips are moving, don't believe them.
Absolutely.
Okay? So oh, does it ever tick me off to see those guys? Oh, and they think it's virtue. If they think it's virtue to have all these people dying, it's Anyway,
it is nothing short of satanic.
Let me cover verses 7 through 10. The it in verse 7, by the way, and let me see. It says. It says, therefore, thus saith Yah, your slain, whom you have laid in the midst of it, they are the flesh, and this city is the cauldron, but I will bring you forth out of the midst of it. Now, the it there is the city of chapter 6, of verse 6, rather. Adonai Yah says, your slain, whom you have slain in the midst of it, which is talking about the human sacrifices the Kohanim have offered to the sun, this very morning in Shlomo's temple. Now, remember that this prophecy began in chapter 8, and it has been a continual narrative. There has been no break. The opening words of chapters 9 through 11 have been, in chapter 9 and verse 1, he cried into my ears. Then in 10 and verse 1, then I looked, and moreover the Ruach lifted me in chapter 11. With no break in the action, the city of Yerushalayim is likened to a cauldron of soup in which the citizens are the meat. Now, I don't think that Yah is being literal exactly. I don't think he's going to be I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of cannibalism going on, though there may be some.
Oh, wait a second.
But the Kohanim.
Wait.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, wait, MP, we just finished in the annual Torah cycle talking about the curses in Deuteronomy chapter 28 last week, and that's precisely what he says, and it's not the only place.
Exactly.
So don't discount that any more than we discount the human sacrifice that's going on. And by the way, as Aminia pointed out, whenever you see so much emphasis on TV to cannibalism, literally glorifying it and normalizing it and saying, oh, this is what's coming, you can pretty well expect that's part of the predictive programming.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I'm surprised that the station is still on. Anyway, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of cannibalism going on, though there may be some. But the Kohanim are offering the citizens to Baal, probably while calling Baal Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. They had perverted their ministries that much. Now here's a Zamra on verse 8. They say, but in just the same way as Yirmiyahu warned the remaining inhabitants of Jerusalem that the sword, famine, and plague were very shortly to be unleashed upon them, that was in Jeremiah 29:17, so his disciple Yehezkel, I don't think it was his disciple, I think it was his father. Anyway, Ezekiel is the son of Jeremiah, I think. So his disciple Ezekiel is now told to prophesy that Yah would bring against them the very sword they feared. That's in verse 8 of our present chapter. And here's what verse 8, here's my commentary on verse 8. You've already read it. Verse 8, Adonai Yah brings the city's fears upon them, namely war and its main consequences, death, destruction, and probable captivity. But before they are utterly devoured by the war their enemy is bringing, Yah, in verse 9, brings them out of the city to be taken away captive to Babylon, where they will receive a just recompense that Yah deems appropriate. Azamra, on verse 10, says this, you shall fall by the sword. I shall judge you at the border of Israel. Verse 10. The border of Israel refers to Rivlah in the land of Hamath in 2 Kings chapter 25 and verse 21. This is the town of Antioch or Antakya in modern day Turkey, where Nebuchadnezzar was encamped while his armies took Jerusalem, and where he judged and captured King Zedekiah and killed his sons in front of his eyes before blinding him. Antioch is the northern boundary of the promised land, and that's Numbers chapter 34 and verse 8, and it says, see Rashi on verse 10 of our present chapter. Heard some noise. In verse 10, Yah tells of their fall, which is again from the Hebrew 5307, nafal, physically to fall or metaphorically to drop down. And in this case, anyway, it probably means both, to physically lose their nation and to lose esteem in their own eyes. He is judging them in the border, that is, Gavul, the Hebrew 1366, setting boundaries or extending dominion of Israel. Okay, in the border, they're setting the boundaries or extending the dominion of Israel. In the near future, they will have their boundaries set by Babylon, but in future, Yah will extend their borders in his kingdom age. The last phrase of verse 10 is an upside, because Israel Yehuda will know that Yah is, and that he is ultimately watching out for them. In both scenarios, Israel will know who has their back. The only person that has Israel's back is Yah, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. He's the only guy that's got their back. Everybody else hates them and wants them destroyed. Okay. That's what I got to understand.
Okay. So we continue?
We can.
All right. So you shall know, Ki Ani Yahuwah is where we ended here. And that you shall know that, and he's going to say it again, of course. This shall not be your cauldron, nor shall you be in the meat in its midst. I will judge with the border of Israel. And, here we go again, and you shall know, Ki Ani Yahuwah, for you have not walked in my statutes, nor executed my judgments, but have done according to the customs of the Goyim, which are all around you. Now, that's an interesting word. It's rendered in this Bible I'm looking at, the New King James, as the Gentiles. And in this particular case, unlike other places, I don't have much of a problem with that rendering, because these are pagans. So, yes, Gentiles sometimes is used by Jewish speakers to mean anybody other than the house of Judah, but the reference to Gentiles is often associated with pagan nations, and in this case, I don't think there's probably much doubt that that's also apropos. Now, it happened, says the prophet, while I was prophesying, that Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, died. Then I fell on my face, and I cried with a loud voice, and I said, O Yahuwah Eloheka, will you make a complete end of the remnant of Israel? That's an interesting observation and a question. Go ahead, Mark. Let's pause there.
Okay, good. I'll cover 11 through 13 here. Yah tells his people, those who are tuned in anyway, that they will not be made Babylon's food. Not be your cauldron. Cauldron is from the Hebrew 55:18, Seir, and to contain or to enclose and protect. For now Yah will contain them in captivity, where they will learn some humility. But he ultimately will enclose Yehuda Israel and protect them from her enemies, even herself sometimes. Okay? He'll have to protect Israel, Yehuda, from themselves. Remember that the ultimate fulfillment of this prophecy is pretty much the same as all prophecy. The millennial reign of Mashiach on this earth and the future age of the new heavens and earth, in which will dwell only righteousness. That was or is Yah's purpose in this creation, eternal life in his presence. In verse 12, Yah reminds us of the three seasons that we need a comeuppance. Reminds us of the three reasons we need a comeuppance. Sorry. Disobedience to his statutes, failure to execute his decisions, and doing what would feel good, like their heathen neighbors. Remember the mantra of the late 60s and early 70s? If it feels good, do it. That's where Yehuda Israel had gotten at this point. And that was the catalyst of the Jesus movement in the mid to late 1970s in America and around the world, which was pretty good in its day, but wasn't quite what Yah wanted, which was a complete 180. Jesus freaks got us about two-thirds of the way back, okay? But it's gone away again. Now, Azamar has this on verse 15. And it came to pass, while I prophesied, that Pelatiah, son of Benaiah, died in verse 13. The sudden death of one of the most prominent leaders of the 25 idolaters, whom Ezekiel saw in the temple courtyard, was part of his prophetic vision and did not actually occur until later, for according to the Talmud in Kiddushin 72b, Pelatiah went into exile in Babylon. Ezekiel's vision of his sudden death came to confirm that the illusions of the defiant inhabitants of Jerusalem would simply burst like a bubble. And that's what Azamar has to say in verse 13. Here's what I have to say. Verse 13 has Pelatiah from the Hebrew 64:10, Pelat, which means to break out or to escape, keeling over dead at Yehezkel's prophecy. What would that put a fear of Yah in them? Not likely. But Yehezkel saw Pelatiah croak and immediately fell on his face before Yah to try to stay the plague that was about to break out. Here's TSK, Treasury Scripture Knowledge on that matter from my Blue Letter Bible. It says, whilst the prophet in vision was delivering this message to the princes, Pelatiah suddenly died, and it is highly probable that he was actually struck dead at this very time, in so remarkable a manner as to render the vision much noticed. The prophet, alarmed and distressed for the welfare of his people, anxiously inquired whether Yah wanted
Okay, hang on, MP. We've got to pick it up there after we come back.
But they never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war.
We are back, folks. This is the final segment for today of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh edition and the book of Ezekiel, chapter 11. When we went to the break, MP went into the break, and the music came up, and he couldn't hear it, and we couldn't hear him. So I'm just going to say, hey, Mark, start back where you were, and we'll pick it up and see what we got.
All right. Okay. I'm going to start back at verse 12, then. Yah reminds us of the three persons we need comeuppance, okay? Three reasons we need a comeuppance. Disobedience to his statutes, failure to execute his decisions, and doing what would feel good, like their heathen neighbors. Remember the mantra in the late 60s and 70s, if it feels good, do it. That's where Yehuda Israel had gotten, and that was the catalyst for the Jesus movement in the mid to late 70s in America and around the world, which was pretty good in its day, but wasn't quite what Yah wanted, which was a complete 180. Jesus freaks got us about two-thirds of the way there. Now, Azamra has this on verse 13. And it came to pass when I prophesied that Pelatyahu, son of Benaiah, died, in verse 13. The sudden death of one of the most prominent leaders of the 25 idolaters whom Ezekiel saw in the temple courtyard was part of his prophetic vision and did not actually occur until later. For according to the Talmud in Kiddushin 72b, Pelatyahu went into exile in Babylon. Ezekiel's vision of his sudden death came to confirm that the illusions of the defiant inhabitants of Jerusalem would simply burst like a bubble. You want to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I thought I heard you break in. Okay, verse 13 has Pelatyah, okay, from the Hebrew 64:10, palat, which means to break out or to escape, keeling over dead in Yechezkel's prophecy. Would that put the fear of Yah in them? Well, it was not likely. But Yechezkel saw Pelatyah croak and immediately fell on his face before Yah to try to stay the plague that was about to break out. Here's TSK on this matter. Whilst the prophet, in vision, was delivering his message to the princes, Pelatyah suddenly died, and it was highly probable that he was actually struck dead at this time, this very time, in so remarkable a manner as to render the vision much noticed. The prophet, alarmed and distressed for the welfare of his people, anxiously inquired whether Yah meant to destroy the remnant of Israel. In verse 13, that's what I've got through verse 13. Got any questions
or comments? Okay, I'm ready to continue on. So, again, the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying, Son of man, your brethren, your relatives, your countrymen, and all of Beit Israel, all the house of Israel in its entirety, those about whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, get far away from Yahuwah, this land has been given to us as a possession. So, therefore, say, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, although I have cast them far off among the nations of Goyim, the Gentiles, and although I have scattered them among the countries, yet I shall be a little sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. So therefore, he says, say, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, I will gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you've been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they will go in there, and they will take away all its detestable things and all its abominations from there. Then I will give them one heart, and I will put a new ruach, a new spirit within them, and take away the stony heart out of their flesh, and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes, and keep my judgments, and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Let's pause there, MP, because we've all heard that one, and see what it points to. Go ahead.
Okay, here's what I got through 14 through 18. The Zamra, by the way, on verse 14 and 15 has a pretty lengthy comment, and it's a good one. Ezekiel cried out in horror at what he saw in verse 13. But in verse 14, Elohim answered him by explaining the wickedness of Pelatyahu and the other defiant inhabitants of Jerusalem. Our commentators explained that the seemingly repetitious phrasing of verse 15, your brothers, your kinsmen, and all the house of Israel is in its entirety, comes to allude to the successive stages in which first the exile of the 10 tribes and then of the king, Jehoiakim, had taken place prior to this prophecy. And it says to see Rashi and Metzudat on verse 17, or 15 rather. The remaining wicked inhabitants of Jerusalem under Zedekiah were scoffing at these exiles, saying, get you far from Hashem, for to us is this land given in possession, verse 15, as if God himself had cast out the exiles to far off lands and would no longer watch over them, giving those in Jerusalem the entire country of Israel in perpetuity. A similar brand of snobbery is not unknown today among certain Israelis, who simply dismissed the whole of the diaspora Jewry as being of no significance. Okay, that's Zamra. Now, yeah, until they need some financial or military help from the Plishtim, the Philistines, the Palestinians, then the diaspora Jews are beloved brethren. Okay, now, in verse 14, as we get into the intro of verse 15, Yah came on Yechezkel like your Mormon missionary Amway distributor again. Ben-Adam, your brothers, and I mean those of your own family and the rest of Yehuda, have been told to get out of Jerusalem, but are refusing to leave, and Yah is trying to disabuse them of that useless thinking. They must go into Babylon, or they may or will lose it all, including their own worthless skin. That's a marked paraphrase of what that was going on there. The entire nation, except for a few, well, at least one, faithful priests, and just plain folk, has walked away from Yah, which is why he'd used Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon to carry them away to Babylon, after giving them an earful from Yirmiyahu. If the prophet had kept his mouth shut, he would not have had a book of scripture named for him, and Yehuda Israel would have had an excuse, lame as it might have been. Well, the land had been given to Hol Yisrael, but under conditions that even the Kohanim had refused to live by. For them to keep the land, the Levi'im would need to keep his Torah and faithfully represent Yah to the rest of the house of Israel. All, with a very few exceptions, Yirmiyahu, Baruch, and Yechezkel in this generation, had turned away from Torah and Yah. The people of Yerushalayim are represented at the end of verse 15 by this: get you far from Yah, unto us is this land given in possession. And if they were all, as if they were all that. Okay, Yah gave them this little tidbit in verses 15 to 18. Son of man, thy brethren, the men of thy kindred and all the house of Israel, holy, they unto whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, get you far from Yah, unto us is this land given in possession. Therefore say, thus saith Adonaiah, although I have cast them far off among the heathen, and although I have scattered them among the countries, yet will I be to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they shall come. Therefore say, thus saith Adonai Yah, I will even gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof, and all the abominations thereof from thence. Here's a Zamra, in verses 16 through 18, and the synagogue system. They say this, these are almost the first words of any kind of comfort that we have had so far in the book of Ezekiel. See Ezekiel chapter 5 and verse 3. Anyway, promising that those who had submitted to the decree of exile would in fact remain under God's constant providence and protection. Despite the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, they would have a little sanctuary in the form of the synagogues in which they would pray during their exile. The phrase in this verse, Mikdash Me'at, a little sanctuary, is one of the foundations of the idea that the synagogue building becomes sanctified with the sanctity akin to that of the temple in virtue of its being used for the communal prayer services, and it must therefore be treated with the appropriate respect. That according to Megillah 29a, Rambam, Laws of Prayer, Chapter 11, all of that stuff. Indeed, it was through the vibrant community life in their synagogues, study halls, and community centers that the Jews of the diaspora kept the torch of Torah burning brightly through thousands of years of exile. And I shall gather you from the nations, in verse 17. Since even the exiles themselves thought that they would never return to their own land and that those in Jerusalem would inherit it, he therefore says to them, I shall gather you in. Shall is much, much more powerful than will, by the way. I shall gather you in, and then I shall bring you back to the land of Israel. This is speaking about the days of Mashiach, according to Metsudas David. In verse 18, we learn that the returning exiles will cleanse the land of all the abominations that had been practiced there. May this come soon and in our days. Amen and amen. And that's what I got through verse 18. If you'd like to comment some, more than happy to listen up.
Well, okay. And so, comment with you. There's definitely a different kind of a twist on that. It's interesting that it comes from a very Jewish perspective and the little sanctuaries.
Yes.
What I always find interesting, MP, is this is vaguely reminiscent of Jeremiah 31, and it's one of the places that people will point to and say, here is a prophecy of, as you said, the Messianic age. And it's interesting that they don't believe it's happened yet, because on that score, I have to say this probably is the right understanding. In other words, Jeremiah 31, if you read that and you see that, this is a prophecy of the new covenant, well, it hasn't happened yet either, because it says it'll no longer be necessary when it does happen for everyone to teach his neighbor, saying, know Yahuwah, because they'll all know him from the least of them to the greatest of them. Well, come on, can anybody actually say that anything approaching that would have anything to do with what we see in America today? Do any, especially in the swamp, know him? So this has a similar kind of a flavor to it. Therefore, thus says Yahuwah, I'll gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you've been scattered, and I'll give you the land of Israel. Okay, that may be a messianic prophecy, but it certainly, at least the way I would look at it, it hadn't happened yet. Go ahead, Mark.
Where have you read through?
I just read through verse 20, into 21.
Verse 20. Okay, why don't you finish 21?
Okay.
And then I'll comment on all that.
But as for those whose hearts follow the desire for their detestable things, their bunnies, their eggs, their Christmas trees, need I say more, and their abominations, I will recompense their deeds on their own heads, says Yahuwah Eloheka. Now he says,
there you go.
You want to pause there?
Let me pause there and I'll move on from here. In verses 19 to 21, that's what I'm commenting on next. The prophecy is not entirely fulfilled to this day. He will give us all one heart, and that heart, with a capital H, will have to be his own through submission to the Ruach HaKodesh, which I seriously doubt that any of us has fully experienced, and that we all deal with the natural tendency to sin. Only by submitting to the heart of Yah will we all be with one accord. That phrase is used only once in Tanakh, and it isn't Israel who is in one accord. In Yehoshua chapter 9 and verses 1 and 2, it says this, "And it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the valleys, and in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite heard, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord." Seven nations working as one man to keep Israel from entering their ancestral land, Israel's ancestral land. The phrase is used 13 times in the New Testament, 12 in the book of Acts and 1 in Philippians. One of those times was when Stephen was stoned to death, okay, with one accord. The idea of being of one heart has always been Yah's desire for his people. He wants our hearts to be as his heart. And as long as we live in this fallen flesh, it will be difficult to attain. But the day is coming, and I believe it is to arrive very soon by our reckoning, well, by my reckoning anyway, being almost halfway through my 69th year of breathing air. There are at least 7 years before the millennial kingdom of Mashiach, and 1,007 years, rather, before the new creation, my own personal opinion. But those things already exist in the mind of Avinu, and it will be the 1,007 plus years before the start of human living in one accord, okay? Humans are not going to live in one accord till after the millennium, all right? Believe it. Even during the millennial kingdom, there will be divisions. It will be more or less united under an iron will of Mashiach Yeshua and controlled locally by his vice regents, but there will not be true unity or one accord. Mazamra has this, verse 19, "And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within them, and I will take the heart of stone out of their flesh, and I will give them a heart of flesh." That's in verse 19. One heart means that their hearts will no longer be divided and in doubt as to whether to believe in Hashem, for they will believe in Hashem with all their heart. A new spirit means a new willingness to follow his laws. And a heart of stone is a hard heart as stone, whereas a heart of flesh is a heart soft as flesh, submissive and easygoing. Noach is what that Hebrew word is. The stubborn remaining inhabitants of Jerusalem had said, "We are the flesh," in verse 3. Remember how I dealt with that verse way back when? Anyway, but God promises that those purified by the tribulations of the long exile that will have a heart of flesh at the end of days. When Rabbi Nachman arrived at the town of Breslau, which became his center for most of the last 8 years of his life, 1802 to 1810, he said that his followers would always be called Breslover Chasadim, revealing that the Hebrew letters of Breslov are the same as the phrase in our verse, Lev Basar, a heart of flesh. That's kind of cool. Anyway, did you see how verse 20 is worded? "I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit in you," speaking directly to Yechezkel. Yah then defines of one accord from his in verse 20. He has given them the new heart, one that is after his heart, and they will naturally walk after his ways, not just acknowledging his Torah, but living in it of their own accord. That, I hope and pray, is the heart of every person now listening. If any man is in Mashiach, in 2 Corinthians 5:17, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away, behold, all things are become new. The only way we can be assured of walking in his will for us is to allow him to change our hearts from stone to flesh. That isn't what the priests in the temple were doing, and therefore neither were the people of Yerushalayim who followed the instructions of the officiating priests. The priests themselves, in verse 21, were walking after the heart of detestable things and their abominations, and leading the people of Yerushalayim to their destruction. And Adonijah promises that he will recompense. He will repay them personally. That's what I got through verse 2.
Okay, you broke up at the end there, but I think okay. I got it. So, but as for those who follow the detestable things, we read through that. So the next thing says, so the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the Elohim of Israel high above them. And the glory of Yahuwah went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. Then the Ruach, the Spirit, took me up and brought me in a vision by the Ruach Elohim into Chaldea. Or Babylon is a another way to translate that, says the footnotes here, to those in captivity. And the vision that I had seen went up from me. So I spoke to those in captivity of all the things Yahuwah had shown me. And that basically is where the chapter ends. We're getting pretty close to the end of our. Go ahead, Mark. Let's talk about that last bit here.
All right, I got a little bit on that. Now, the cherubim spread their wings, and the kavod of Yah seems to me to be lifting the cherubim. The Hebrew of cherubim is keruv, to cover, or karav, rather, to cover, with EDBH's explanatory meaning of a protecting angel with a child's face, okay, a cherub, or a vehicle for Yah's presence, as if Yah needs a vehicle of any kind. Now, here's a Zamra on verse 23. And the glory of Hashem went up from the midst of the city, in verse 23. This verse brings us to the conclusion of the series of prophecies that began in chapter 8, in verse 1, when the form of a hand coming out of the fire took Yehezkel by the fringes of his head from Babylon to the temple courtyard in Jerusalem, where he witnessed the abominations that the people were committing there, and simultaneously the withdrawal of the divine presence in the stages from the temple. It was the divine presence and its chariot that he had originally seen in his opening vision by the river Kivar in Ezekiel chapter 1, and in the plain in Ezekiel 3 and verse 23. Now, at the end of his prophetic vision of being in the temple courtyard, Yehezkel sees the chariot finally departing the city of Jerusalem and standing on the mountain, verse 23 of our present chapter. This is the Mount of Olives, which stands to the east of the city. That according to Rashi. Now you may remember that in verse 1, Yah had brought Zeke to the east gate of the temple, which looks east towards the Mount of Olives. As you may also remember, it is possible that the place where crucifixions took place in Roman times could have been on the Mount of Olives, but that isn't conclusive. Calvary is in the temple city proper, and it does resemble a human skull. I don't think that is correct, but I could be wrong. I wasn't there 2,000 years ago to witness the event. So I have only other people's opinions to base my thinking on. Therefore, I am not going to commit myself to one position or another. I know that it was within a relatively short walk from Pilate's palace to the killing field, because Yeshua was pretty well beat up by the time that they placed his torture stake on his shoulder. I lean towards Gordon's for that reason, Gordon's Calvary. It just seems like making that trip after what Yeshua had been through would have been very difficult, even with Shimon's help dragging the torture stake. Now, verse 23 has the glory departing towards the east, presumably to the Mount of Olives. This may be the best evidence that Yeshua was crucified on the Mount of Olives, since his glory left the city and stopped, perhaps for a few minutes, above Olivet. After stopping there for a bit, in verse 23, the Ruach, the Kavod of Yah, stopped above Olivet, kind of for a last look at the beloved but defiled city, before returning Yehezkel's spirit, in verse 24, to Chaldea, and the vision ending in Yehezkel telling those in Babylon about his visions. And that is the end of the chapter. And we've got about 10 seconds, maybe 20 seconds left.
We got about half a minute. So, okay. Well, so We'll see next week if Ken wants to add anything to what he hopefully heard later if he didn't get to catch the show here. But after this, we're going to continue to talk about idolatry. That seems to be a major theme of the major prophets, and it ought to be because it certainly seems to be a major theme today. So I guess with that, Mark, I'll say, hey, any final comments? Otherwise, just say say adios, and we'll be waiting for the music.
Adios. The music will be up here in about 10 seconds. So.
Okay, well, shalom, folks. Thanks. Well, yeah. And again, be aware of what times and seasons we're at because they are extremely important, especially this year. Thanks. Shalom.